right to them. Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer. Today we're continuing our interview with none other than Mr. Bob Inyart.
Hey, Fred, it's great to be back at Real Science
great
Radio.
To have you in the studio, Bob.
Well, it's such an honor to get a paper published in a creation journal, CRSQ.
That's right, the spring edition of the Creation Research Society Quarterly. Mm-hmm. And we're going through the article that you published entitled Dobzhansky, 40 Years Later, Nothing Makes Sense.
Yeah.
And he's famous for that quote where he says, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." I don't know how many times I've heard that through the years.
What a whopper.
It's a whopper.
Yeah.
And I think you wrote a fantastic article. I know I'm biased, but it really is. It's just tremendous.
Thank you.
And I encourage people to get a subscription to the CRSQ, and then you can read this article. It's online right now.
Yeah, CRSQ.org.
CRSQ.org.
A membership or just the subscription?
Yes. And then you can read this article online and it'll be available in print soon. I'm sure it's going to be out in the mail pretty soon, but we always try to get things on the online section before it actually hits the presses, so to speak, and is mailed out. So I had a chance to read this again, and it was such a fantastic article, and we're going to go through it. But Bob, if it's okay, I'd love to have our producer play a commercial.
A commercial. This is commercial-free radio.
It's
commercial-free,
but this one was cool. I mean, I'm driving to work in the morning, and it's a secular station. It's 710, AM 710, KNUS.
In Denver.
Steve Kelly.
Oh, he's great.
I tune into that station every now and then, and like probably a lot of people, I'm flipping the dial here and there. And usually when a commercial comes, I kind of either turn the station or I just zone out. Well, in this particular case, I was kind of zoned out, but then I started hearing an interesting commercial, and I'm like, wow, these guys are really hitting it right out of the park.
What was it about?
It was about abortion, about the personhood amendment.
Whoa, in Colorado.
In Colorado.
Our Brady Amendment, personhood. Yeah.
It's a pro-life commercial. So I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be, you know, your typical softball stuff.
Yeah.
And this wasn't. This was really hard hitting, but in a good way. Ooh. It really gets to the truth.
Wow.
And I think it's worth playing this commercial.
An abortionist has been convicted of murder. Kermit Gosnell's House of Horrors closed. But Colorado kills many kids from conception through late term. Like Brady Surovic, killed by a drunk driver, these kids are persons. Yet listen to Princeton University's Peter Singer.
No, I don't think it's problematic to say the four-month-old baby is not actually a person. I think that's simply true.
This is widespread and even taints the White House. It's up to us to stop this taking of innocent life. The University of Colorado's Michael Tooley advocates both abortion and infanticide. Discover Magazine defends the evolution of infanticide. The New York Times published a call to kill newborns. So did the Journal of Medical Ethics. It's up to us to stop the horror. Sign the Pro-Life Brady Amendment. It's urgent. Call any Colorado personhood group to get a petition. Or just go to avoiceforbrady.com. That's avoiceforbrady.com.
That's a fantastic commercial, Bob.
Wow. Thank you, Fred. I was honored when Colorado Right to Life asked me, would I voice this commercial, saying, look, it's not only abortion. Abortion is the murder of innocent children, but we're talking about full-blown infanticide, that what Kermit Gosnell was doing in Philadelphia is what leaders are advocating all over this country and around the world, that it should be legal to kill newborns. And that's the same thing as killing the baby in the womb. Anyway.
Yeah, we know there's a connection with this worldview, with the belief in evolution. It's, you know, their religion of evolution helps them justify in their minds thinking like this. I mean, worldviews have consequences. Yeah. You believe that you're evolved from a pile of slime, that you're evolved from animals. Then why are we surprised when people treat other people like animals?
Fred, what famous evolutionist is pro-life? You know, how about Richard Dawkins?
No.
Or P.Z. Myers?
No.
Jerry Coyne?
No.
Any of these guys? Eugenie Scott? Michael Shermer? None of
these
guys.
They're all pro-abortion.
Right.
Without question.
Right. It is a worldview thing. God made us in his image, or we're animals.
That's right. So, Bob, back to this, again, fantastic article.
Thank you.
In the Creation Research Society Quarterly. Now, this is a peer-reviewed journal, so it's not easy to get an article published in this journal. And I know last show we talked about the rigorous process you have to go through to get it published. So I want to dive right back into this thing.
Cool.
Now, the next thing you talk about is how Dobzhansky failed to credit Christian creationists, and there's many of them, the founding fathers of the major branches of science. They were all bleeding heart evolutionists.
No, they weren't.
They weren't.
So many of the fathers of the natural sciences were creationists.
Virtually all of them.
Some of them hardcore Christian creationists, Bible creationists, virtually all of them working from a Judeo-Christian worldview.
Now, you do have one shoddy scientist on this list. I don't know why he's on there, but why is Sir Isaac Newton on this list? He was so bad. He didn't know anything.
That's right.
He was a creationist.
So, you know, for Dobzhansky to make fun of that sheik from Saudi Arabia who believed that the sun went around the earth, right?
Yeah, so let's remind the audience, he made a prediction that this guy, he could never convince him that he was wrong. That was his first prediction.
Yeah, and it turns out that sheik, 1985, said, oops, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, now I know that the earth goes around the sun.
So strike one on that prediction.
Yeah, because he did look at and see the evidence in a way that he could trust.
Yeah, and he's just slamming, you know, creationists when he starts his article like that.
Right.
It's so
guilt
common
by
for,
association.
Yeah, and it's very common for evolutionists to do that.
So if that whole geocentrism thing, if we're really supposed to learn a lesson from that, well, then the lesson should be that we receive that from pagans like Plato and Ptolemy. That's where we got that the sun goes around the earth.
Yeah, so
from
that's where that
Plato,
came from.
Pagan Greek Plato, from Ptolemy, whereas it was Christian creationists
who turned that whole thing around.
Right, like Copernicus, Johann Kepler, Isaac Newton. They're the ones who ended that science stalling reign of geocentrism.
But what about Galileo? Didn't the church come down hard on him and the church is against science and all this?
That's right. And of course, they bring up Galileo, even though it was Christians who taught the world that the earth goes around the sun. Then, of course, they bring up Galileo. And so we address that in this article. And it turns out that just like Isaac Newton, Galileo's revolution, it wasn't against the Bible, but it was against the defenders of Aristotle because it was the intellectuals of his day that were adamant that the sun went around the earth, and they did so because they were defenders of Aristotle, who was a student of Plato.
Yeah, and like the Bible says, things don't change under the sun. I mean, here we have revisionist history, and how many times do we see that? I mean, so when you hear that, you know, the church was against Galileo, so the church is anti-science, they just do that. That's bad history. That's misinformation.
Right. And so you know what Dobzhansky does at the end of his introduction to his article, Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution, at the end of it, you know, he doesn't credit these leading creationists for this amazing accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Instead, he brings up Gauss. He wrote a book called Omphalos. And he claimed in this book, this was 2 years before Darwin published Origin of Species. And he claimed that the fossil record was created, right? So that when God created, he put fossils in the rocks to give them an appearance of age. Well, that's not true. That's a fallacious claim. He's not a popular creationist. 99 out of 100 evolutionists and creationists could never recall this guy's name or his book.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's sort of a straw man argument and, you know, painting creationists to look bad referring to some crackpot example.
Exactly. So his introduction ends with yet another attempt to convict modern creationists through guilt by association. So to sum up Dobzhansky's introduction of this revered article, it's wrong on its first prediction.
About the Arab sheik.
About the sheik. It uses the logical fallacies of guilt by association, arbitrary accusation, and an unjustified appeal to authority. It does all of that.
So he's off to a great start.
Yes. So now he gets to his next section. He titled it Diversity of Living Beings. And now this is going to get more interesting because Dobzhansky now presents his argument for evolutionary biology.
Oh, this ought to be fun.
Yeah, it is. But you know what we're going to see? That it's just as unscientific, arbitrary, and circular as his introduction was. Now, that's quite a claim, I know.
Yeah.
But we'll see. We're going to go through it. Just like a creationist, to start with, Dobzhansky describes with awe the range of life.
With awe.
Yeah. And good for him.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
We do that too, from microorganisms to whales. It's astounding when you look at the cosmos. It's astounding what we see, and creationists agree. That's not an argument in favor of chaos. He starts out saying, wow, look at all this diversity of life. Well, that's cool. But it's arbitrary for Dobzhansky to imply that the wonder of life is evidence against creation. That is just flat out arbitrary.
So, Bob, and I love how you point out that us as creationists, we've long documented that evolutionists frequently argue in circles. I don't know how many times I've talked with an evolutionist.
Round and around and around
they
we
love
go.
To yeah. argue in circles.
Yeah.
So as an example, when they try to account for the unexpected complexity of life, like you just mentioned, they typically invoke far greater complexity. I mean, how many times we've seen that? You mentioned chaos earlier.
Yeah.
A lot of times when I'm arguing with someone who's not as well educated as, you know, as some evolutionists, they'll mention chaos theory.
As though that proves everything.
Yeah, it's just a magic wand. And so they appeal to more complexity to try to explain
right.
the complexity.
Right.
It's a completely circular argument. Another example is consider a single living cell. This is a humorous one. They appeal to space aliens to account for that one.
Yeah, space travel.
The guy who discovered DNA, he's a bright guy. You know, he's a co-discoverer of DNA, Francis Crick.
Right.
It pretty much, for him, it refuted neo-Darwinism, which this Dobzhansky is the father of that particular idea.
Right.
For Francis Crick, he's like, okay, natural selection and random mutations, that can't account for DNA. But by golly, I'm going to stay committed as an atheist evolutionist. So aliens seeded the planet.
Alien civilization.
And there's plenty of evolutionists who believe that.
In fact, Richard Dawkins stated that in the movie Expelled.
That's
a possibility, he says. And so, Fred, to account for a single cell, the complexity in one cell, they propose space travel and alien civilizations.
Yeah, they push the problem out into space and back in time.
More complicated.
So how much more complicated is the super alien that seeded the alien planet? And then I guess you got to go back another billions and millions of years on one of their 10 to the 500 universes, and you got another guy.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's Spock. I don't know.
So they hope to explain the unexpected complexity and the perfectionist fine-tuning of the universe by appealing to multi-trillions of parallel universes. It really is very humorous to observe. So they invoke greater complexity to explain complexity, and they seem to be completely unaware of this, Fred, and they don't realize that they're not answering that origin of life question you just referenced when they say, well, life is too complex to have originated here, so it must have begun elsewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Huh? So it's really fun. But now, at this point in his paper, we come to what Dobzhansky refers to as the highly significant evidence for the claim in his title that only evolution explains things. He argues that because of the uncertainty of how to characterize a virus, he writes that a virus is on the borderline between living and inanimate matter. And, you know, that's a good point, right?
Mm-hmm.
People, scientists have a hard time saying exactly what a virus is.
Yes.
Because it can't reproduce on its own. So they hesitate to say it's a life form. So he says, okay, a virus, we don't know how to characterize it. Therefore, it is evidently at the simple end of the spectrum of simplicity to complexity.
So let me get this straight. He's saying the virus is simple.
It must be on the simple.
It's a simpleton.
It must be on the simple
end. I'm a
end.
Simple man, Bob. Is that what he's saying?
Yeah, that's simply what he's saying, that it must be simple. It's on the simple end. But Fred, in his own paper, he points out that a virus has to take over. It has to co-opt the mechanisms of a living cell so that it could function and reproduce itself. So the question becomes then, is the viral system, is it more or less complex than a living cell? Well, it's got to be more complex because you need a living cell as part of the system.
Yes.
So you start with a living cell once again, right? How do you make a star? Start with a star.
Steve Martin says, how do you make $1 million? Well, first, you need $1 million.
That's right. How do you originate species? Well, first, start with species. So you got to start with a cell, and then you add a virus to it. And as Jonathan Sarfati in 2008 wrote an article on the astounding complexity of a virus.
Yeah.
That we're just still learning about.
Just still learning about it. And, hey, not to shortchange a cell. We know how amazingly complex a cell is. Well, right. Dobzhansky was wrong. Viruses are incredibly complex.
Right. They're wildly complex, and the viral system has greater complexity than microorganisms.
Yeah, and it's beautiful design. I mean, it's not like just this wild chaos, you know, when you look at it. It's when we say complex, it's wonderful
it's
engineering.
Sophisticated.
It's a great word, sophistication.
Intricacy, yes. It turns out that Dobzhansky is so biased by his evolutionary theory that it's clouded his ability to see that he's introducing greater complexity to explain complexity.
Yeah, and I love your point here about how you say that because a virus cannot reproduce on its own, by definition, it cannot originate on its own by, guess who? The Darwinistic mechanism.
That's right.
That's a great point, Bob.
Well, thank you. I stole it from Jerry Bergman.
Okay.
So, yeah, he says that when you think about a virus that obliterates the whole problem with a biogenesis, mm-hmm. that life originated allegedly from inanimate matter, and that it does no such thing. What it shows is that he's confused. And then I point out, Fred, in this critique of Dobzhansky 40 years after his article, I point out that if it's true that life could arise if just the right chemicals amassed together, if that were true, then Earth should be popping with new life forms, because at every moment of every day, all over the world, millions of carcasses are in every possible stage of decomposition. Animals die.
Lots of stuff there.
Plants
to make things happen.
Die. A single cell can have thousands of proteins. They're all breaking down. There's quintillions of cells that are in every possible stage of decomposition. They have all the right chemicals, yet no new life.
No, nothing appears.
So that is a little bit of evidence against Darwin's dream that, well, in some warm little pond, you know, it just happened. Just happened. Isn't that scientific? Recently, Fred, they synthesized the building blocks of life, these ribonucleotides.
Mm-hmm.
That was an amazing accomplishment by chemists.
It was an amazing accomplishment, but chemists, now that tells me something, that chemists have a brain.
Yeah.
They're intelligent, yeah. And it's information.
Yes.
So there's already what?
Tremendous intelligent design.
Yes.
Went into designing these ribonucleotides. What's interesting about that is that's just like making bricks. It's a brick. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're trying to explain this palace built to King Ahaz, right? You find his palace, and there's Jezebel's makeup kit in the ruins. So you find this palace, and you say, well, this brick explains the palace. The brick doesn't explain the palace. And a brick is, you know, an amazing thing. A brick. It really is.
Yeah.
Just like a chemist with a very intricately designed experiment building a building block, a ribonucleotide. That's amazing. But that doesn't even approach the question of where did the information come from that the nucleotides possess in order to support life. It doesn't even broach the question.
Yeah, so off they are to where? Outer space again and aliens. I mean, that's what they appeal to.
Right.
Because as we increase in scientific knowledge, as you point out, they have to appeal to
aliens.
It's just amazing.
Billions of universes.
So compelling and overwhelming.
Yeah. So then Dobzhansky makes what is really a pretty good estimate for back then, surveying the literature like he did. He said, you know, the human brain has about 12 billion neurons and about 1,000 times more synapses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the older I get, the less snapping my synapses do. He was in the ballpark.
He's in the ballpark, but he's off by a factor of what, 10?
Well, yeah, neurologists today estimate we have closer to 100 billion neurons with 100 trillion synapses. That's in the average human brain. That's astounding.
That's astounding. And I think in this last 5 seconds, I just lost probably about 10 of those.
Yeah. So Dobzhansky estimated then that how many species do we have in the world of plants and animals? He said, well, we have about 1.5 to 2 million species that have been described, and he guessed we might actually have twice that number. And again, that was pretty good in the ballpark, because you fast forward 40 years, and scientists today, every year they identify about 18,000 new species that they've found and cataloged. And that's increased the total number of known species. This counts microorganisms and everything, archaea and
so that's a lot of diversity.
Yeah, it brings it up. The number is now 1.9 million, which is a lot. But the total number, which is not known, so it's only estimated, is maybe 4 million, maybe 5 to 10 million species. Scientists still don't know, but there's a lot of them.
I wonder if we should take a quick moment to explain, because people ask this question, how would we get 4 million species on the Ark?
What a good question. Well, Fred, we have talked about the recent studies, Answers in Genesis. They're doing a fabulous study. And it turns out that, well, you don't have to take any of the fish, none of the marine reptiles, none of the insects.
No insects.
The Bible says you bring the land-dwelling animals that breathe through their nostrils. So insects have these tubules that they take oxygen in through, but they don't have nostrils.
And they're a big part of this number of species. So you take them out.
Yeah, and microorganisms, mm-hmm. they don't have to be cared for on the Ark. There's probably plenty of them on there. So what you need are mammals, birds, reptiles, and the total number is amazingly low because it's not species, but it's kinds.
Kinds of animals.
Which is more like the genus level.
So like there's like 15 North American jackrabbit species.
Mm.
So do we need to take all those species on the Ark?
No, we don't.
Yeah. And the only reason they're separate species is because they became isolated over time geographically,
mm-hmm.
and they developed different mating habits.
Yeah.
And so they got classified as a different species because they don't interbreed.
They might be geographically separated. They might actually have developed physical barriers toward breeding because of loss of certain types of functionality.
That's right.
But they were originally the same kind.
So you need just one kind of rabbit on the Ark, and we yeah. could easily fit all of those species we talked
about. One kind of wolf, canine.
Yes.
One kind of equus, horse, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need millions of animals on the Ark. You need thousands, and not very many thousands. But then Dobzhansky asks, well, he says, what could explain this colossal diversity? And Freddie calls them biological curiosities. And he describes their existence with all these non-scientific terms. He says that they're whimsical, superfluous, jocular organisms. Okay. And what he's implying, first of all, is that his characterizations are accurate. And I don't know how scientific it is, Fred, to say, well, this organism here is jocular.
Jocular.
This one is whimsical.
And then somehow that supports evolution.
This one is superfluous. Those are not scientific assessments. Also, so that's the first thing. He's implying that these are accurate descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
They're not scientific. And secondly, he's implying that somehow that this favors evolution over creation. How does science determine if something is whimsical, and if it is whimsical, why would that favor evolution?
Yeah.
He never quite connects the dots.
Yeah, so you go on to say that Dobzhansky presents no scientific or theological reasons why a brilliant creator should not be expected to fill the world with the millions of curiously diverse creatures that we see. I mean, I think it's really cool, diversity he programmed into life. It's just amazing, the beauty of it.
Yes.
And somehow that's an argument against creation and a brilliant creator.
It's Fred,
just,
I came out of
the science.
I came out of our home today, this morning. Mm-hmm. The sun is coming up. There are two rabbits in our front yard. They're perfectly happy there.
Yeah.
There's a squirrel going across the street, and there are robins flying overhead. It's just this beautiful picture. And then all the plants and bushes and grass and trees. And then
why would a creator do that?
Why? Just why? How unreasonable is that? And then with all the microorganisms that keep the whole thing functioning.
Yeah, and so as you point out, this is not science. This is philosophy. This is a philosophical argument that he's making.
Not a scientific one. And he writes, the only explanation that makes sense is that organic diversity has evolved.
Wow. So he jumps to that conclusion.
Yeah, so he says it evolved in response to the diversity in the environment, and that's the only explanation that makes sense. Well, that is assuming your conclusion.
Yeah.
It's completely circular.
And this is the article that evolutionists just love to appeal to and jump up and down and clap and shake hands and high-five each other.
Yeah, Dobzhansky,
the big party with, Dobzhansky really hit it on the head.
Fist bump. So claiming diversity favors evolution over creation, that would only be relevant if somehow a creator God could not fine-tune creatures to fit in environmental niches. Who's ever argued that?
Yeah.
I mean, what worldview?
For a creator to create the ability for a life form to adapt. But does that mean that a squirrel who's going to maybe adapt his environment better by having maybe his feet pads change a little bit, is that going to turn him into a bird over time?
Right.
No, there's barriers. There's limits.
Right.
So it helps them in their environment, but they're not going to turn into another creature. But evolutionists would love you to believe that. They take that big leap of faith and they try to present it as science.
Right, exactly. Like dogs that migrate north and it's a colder climate. And so the short-haired dogs die off. So now you have the long-haired dogs.
Yep.
And as the short-haired dogs die off over time, you lose the genes for the short hair. So you've lost information.
So that's natural selection, which we agree happens, right?
But it doesn't mean that dogs could evolve into whales.
So natural selection, it can't create genes. It can certainly remove them, as we've long postulated.
Exactly. Rodicetus, Pachycetus, notwithstanding, dogs, foxes, wolves can evolve into whales just because they could change their hair color.
That's just always been one of the funniest. The wolf-like animals evolving into whales.
Right. Fish became wolves, became whales.
Yeah.
Fish to wolves to whales.
God's got a sense of humor. He put a mammal in the ocean.
Reminds me of Granny.
Granny?
From the Beverly Hillbillies.
Okay.
They move to Beverly. A tour guide takes them to the beach, and he says, Granny, we all evolved from the sea. And she looks out there, and she says, the only sea I came from is Tennessee. Sorry. But anyway, Fred, we're out of time. But when he claims that this diversity is evidence for evolution, that's just assuming your conclusion. It's completely circular. It's going to be fun if we could. You think,
boy,
we
Bob,
could
I think
do
we
more?
Should. Can we do another show on this? I love this because it covers such a wide range of topics.
Yeah.
And again, this is the evolutionist worship at the altar of this article by Dobzhansky.
It'll be fun, right?
It'll be fun.
To put it on
and
the record.
There's so much more to go through. I'd love to have you back next week, Bob.
Right. Oh, thank you. What an honor to be invited to Real Science Radio. And we'll try to resurrect Dobzhansky, see if he could join us.
There you go.
All right. So, Fred, I don't know who closes the show, you or me, but I want to tell people realscienceradio.com. That's our website. If you shop in our science department, you'll help us stay on the air. Some people even make a donation to Real Science Radio, and that's desperately needed to help us stay on the air, reaching many, many people.
Yeah, thank you very much, and Bob, we'll see you next week.
God bless you, Fred.
That's what I'm talking about.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store. Online, realscienceradio.com, click on the store, and there are two fabulous DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. These are by a dear friend of Real Science Radio, Spike Pisaris, and Spike has created simply the greatest astronomy DVDs ever produced. And we have gone through probably hundreds of science DVDs and books, and we recommend only the very best at our store, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and you'll love these astronomy DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. You got to get them.